This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters now. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for being with us again. In recent years, we've heard a lot of discussions about worldview. That is the lens through which we evaluate and we interpret what is going on in the world around us and what it means in our lives. But what is your worldview and how can you test it? Why is that important ultimately? That's what we're going to talk about today with Dr. Tawa Anderson, who is Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Honor Program at Oklahoma Baptist University. He is co-author of the new book we're going to talk about called An Introduction to Christian Worldview, Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World. Dr. Anderson, it's great to have you here. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. This is a great topic. I'm excited to talk about it with you. You say, and I think this is an interesting opening line you have here right at the outset, you say that worldview is a contentious term, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Why do you think it is?
Probably some historical reasons for it. The term itself doesn't really arise until the late 18th century. And so for some lay Christians and Christian scholars even, they have this notion that, well, you know, if worldview as a term and as a discipline doesn't arise until so late, then there's something suspect about it. Two of the other reasons why it can be contentious, there's a lot of thought that maybe worldview is an overly rationalized construct that is just talking about, you know, we need to have the right beliefs. So talking about a Christian worldview is about thinking the right things and having the right beliefs. And that, of course, is not at all what we want to be all about as believers. We do want to have right beliefs, obviously, orthodoxy.
Right.
But we also want to be about right practice and right engagement, orthopraxy. So these misconceptions of worldview make it a contentious term. And then third and finally, I think just the fact that worldview is utilized in a lot of secular disciplines from a non-Christian perspective, again, for some Christians makes it a contentious term.
Yeah. Now, I'm very interested in the first thing that you mentioned, the fact that worldview arose in the late 18th century, because I didn't know it was so long ago. It seems like we've only been discussing worldview in Christian circles with great vigor for the last decade, maybe couple of decades. What was the genesis of the term itself? Where did that come from and who came up with it?
It stems from Immanuel Kant, a German philosopher in the late 18th century, and he used it as just kind of a perspective, as it were, a person's perception of the world around them, from the German word Weltanschauung, which just means view of the world. But it very, very quickly after Kant used it, spread through other German philosophers and very quickly into other European countries, and oftentimes just incorporated as a loan word. They'd use the German Weltanschauung for what they were talking about, but also quickly became transliterated in Danish and then in English and in French. And it came into evangelical circles in the later 1800s, so, you know, 75, 85 years after Kant, through James Orr, and then, of course, in the early 20th century, Abraham Kuyper, the great Dutch theologian and statesman, worldview thinking was very, very prominent in his kind of circles. So even though it has its origins in German philosophy, its introduction into kind of the Protestant or evangelical world is really through Kuyper and his disciples in the Dutch Reformed tradition.
Very interesting. So now when we're talking about a Christian worldview, clearly we understand, because we know the differences between Orthodox Christianity and the other world religions, not to mention all the sects and all the cults that are out there. What is the difference fundamentally between the Christian worldview and all other worldviews? Would you lump them in two categories? Would you give them multiple categories? How would you systematize them, in other words?
You can effectively do it in both ways. I've heard it put, and we don't put it this way on our book, but I think it's an effective way of saying it, that you ultimately have two worldviews, worldviews that are oriented around a recognition and submission to the triune God, and worldviews that are human-centered. So I think that's a fair way of putting it, that you've got Christian worldview and then non-Christian worldviews. But you can also categorize worldviews according to their understanding of, as it were, kind of prime reality or what is ultimate reality. And so you can have theistic worldviews, of which Christianity is one, but other theistic worldviews would also include Islam and Judaism. So there are a lot of kind of points in common in those worldviews in terms of recognizing that there is a transcendent being, that this transcendent being created the universe. So we share those worldview components, but of course then we differ radically in other core worldview areas.
Right. I think that's a perfect way of explaining it. You can simplify it and say there's the Christian worldview and all the other wrong worldviews, human-centered worldviews. But yes, you can actually break that down, as you mentioned before, into different particular religions and particular views of God, theistic, atheistic, and so forth. I'm curious what you might say is the most dominant worldview that's in play right now in the United States. What is it? Postmodernism? Would you say it's secularism, humanistic, pagan? How would you characterize it?
Well, one of the reasons we subtitled the book Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World is because we perceive in the Western world, including in the United States, just a radical pluralism of worldviews. And so identifying a dominant worldview is very difficult. If I was to identify a dominant worldview stream, now understanding this isn't, in my mind, an overarching worldview, right? An overarching worldview answers all of kind of the fundamental worldview questions. What is our nature? What is our world? What is our problem? What is our end? So this is, as it were, kind of a worldview thread, a thread that goes through many different worldviews. But I think egoism is kind of a primary or predominant worldview in the United States, and that's just a self-centeredness, that I am ultimately what matters. But that kind of egoism can exist within a lot of different kind of overarching philosophical or religious worldviews. And one of the things that concerns me as a Christian teacher and minister is the egoism that we sometimes see creeping into the Christian church, yep, where we think it's all about me, it's about what I need or what I desire. You know, I do my church shopping based on my needs and the programs that I want to see or the preaching that I like. And so then, of course, I'm sorry, I'm rambling here a little bit.
No, you're great. You're great.
Of evaluating our own worldview, and if we desire to have a Christian worldview, then being aware of those worldview influences upon us can help us to see that that kind of egoism just does not fit at all with biblical Christianity, and we can become more aware of that. Sorry, the original question was, what worldviews do we see predominant in the United States? So that egoism is a thread that I see as predominant. If I'm to talk about overarching philosophical and religious worldviews, postmodernism, I think, is one. Naturalism is another. Mm-hmm. And in the academic world, I think that's the dominant one. And Christian theism is the third. So I think those are probably the three predominant worldviews, but again, in a very pluralistic kind of society.
Right. Now, I want to get into, when we come back from the break, I want to get into these questions that you asked that are really the questions we have to get answers to determine our individual and maybe our corporate worldviews. But when you say that egoism is a problem within the church today, and I heartily agree with you on that, what are the roots of that? How is it that people who claim to be Christians and are expected to have a Christian worldview based on what they profess as believers in Jesus Christ could incorporate a form of egoism, as you mentioned, as a worldview thread and try to really do a syncretistic blend with Christianity when the whole thrust of Christianity is deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me?
That's an excellent question. And I wonder the same. I have ideas, but that's all that they really are. And one of the things, though, that I am confident of is that throughout history, the Christian church has always been influenced by cultural and intellectual streams around it, even when those streams of thought are non-Christian or just outright pagan and anti-Christian in nature. Right. And this happens, I think, in the 20th and 21st centuries by kind of the egoism that's dominant outside of us just creeping in, whether it's through advertising or commercialism. And so it's in an unconscious way that I think most Christians absorb that egoism into their worldview. Again, if worldview is formed, as we argue that it is, on a pre-theoretical level, meaning that we're not thinking about it while our worldview is developing, then these non-Christian influences become a part of our worldview and we don't even realize it. So for a lot of Christians, again, they're just unaware that there are these alien elements in their worldview and they think that they're just holding a Christian worldview. For example, I think this is fascinating, but studies show that about, I think it's 65 or 70% of American evangelicals believe that there's a Bible verse that says God helps those who help themselves.
Ah, yeah, doesn't that drive you crazy? Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Dr. Tawa Anderson. An Introduction to Christian Worldview is his book, and we'll return right after this on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
It's Thanksgiving week, and my heart fills up with joy and song as I remember just one thing. God is still King. That means there's hope. In the middle of the many difficulties we face personally, as a country, even in the whole world, we can rest on His unwavering love. Remember the old hymn, "This is my Father's world, oh let me ne'er forget, that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world, why should my heart be sad? The Lord is King, let the heavens ring, God reigns, let the earth be glad."
This holiday season, we'll come together to celebrate with family and friends. It's the perfect time to give thanks and to pray for our nation and for each other. Visit CapitolHillBrief.org for a special Thanksgiving prayer guide today. This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. Here is Ann's story.
I had numerous credit cards and I was struggling with paying them off. I had heard about Trinity, so I made the call. They took care of all of my credit cards and now I am completely debt-free. The people at Trinity are very friendly. They will do whatever you need them to do in order for you to feel better about being in a very difficult place. My name is Anne, and thanks to Trinity, I'm debt-free for keeps.
If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your account, put a stop to late fees, and drastically reduce your interest. There is hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. That's 1-800-793-8752. 1-800-793-8752. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Dr. Tawa Anderson, who is Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Director of the Honor Program at Oklahoma Baptist University, and he is co-author of the new book, An Introduction to Christian Worldview, Pursuing God's Perspective in a Pluralistic World. You shared a statistic, Dr. Anderson, before we went to the break, which really hits home with me when you cite this, because I've heard this before, that some number between 65 and 70% of American evangelicals believe there's a Bible verse that says God helps those who help themselves. Which just proves that we don't know our Bibles, right? That's the crux of it, the crux of the problem.
Yeah, and if we hold a Christian worldview, then supposedly it should be founded on God's self-revelation in Scripture. And so if we don't know what Scripture does and doesn't say, we need to ask ourselves the question, how Christian is my Christian worldview?
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about some of these core worldview questions that you talk about in the book that you say are at the heart of every single worldview. Beginning with this question, what is our nature? Break this down a little bit, because as you're walking through these questions, it really answers a lot of the mysteries for people about how to unlock a worldview and figure out what it exactly is. But for the Christian, we know that our nature is sinful. What more should we know in order to really have a truly biblical worldview?
Well, Pascal puts his finger on it very well. He says, man is both the most noble and the most depraved of all creatures. And so the depraved side is the fact that we are fallen,
right?
That we were created in the image of God. That's the noble side. So we're the most noble of all creatures because we alone bear that image of God. But because of the fall, we are radically depraved. And so we're separated from God. And we're just utterly sinful and incapable of doing anything on our own about it. So that dual notion that we're created in God's image and therefore we have inherent dignity and worth and value, but we're also fallen and because of that capable of the greatest evils, those I think are two of the absolutely crucial things we need to understand about our nature.
That's perfect. Now, how would that go over and against some other worldviews when you look at the egoism in the worldviews that you've talked about, postmodern worldview, for example, or the naturalistic worldview, they certainly wouldn't take the view that we are, they might say we're dignified, but they certainly wouldn't say that we're fallen.
That's right. So they'll emphasize one side or the other. And all three of the worldviews that you mentioned, well, yeah, they'll emphasize the goodness or the greatness of man, but will totally overlook the fall. And a lot of really horrific worldview implications historically have stemmed from that, including, in my mind, things like the French Revolution, the Communist Revolution, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's philosophy that said, you know, man is just good, and if we could just get rid of corrupt institutions like the church and government, all things would be fine. Well, no, anarchism and communism, because of the sinfulness of human people, end up being even worse than the things that were potentially problematic before them.
Right. Not to mention the fact that the church and the government are made up of people. So how in the world?
Yes.
You got the same problem there when you have people involved.
Yep.
Yeah. So true. All right. And then when you get to the question, what is our world? The Christian, obviously, we know that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There is a divine creator. And we understand from the first chapter of the Gospel of John that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The nature of the Trinity in creation. This is opposed, obviously, to the postmodern view, the naturalistic worldview. And what difference does this make? Because when you have someone, for example, who embraces Darwinian evolution and is a naturalist and takes out of the equation the dignity of man as formed in God's image, this changes everything, because all of a sudden you don't have the same moral standard, right? You're not held to the same moral standard that a Christian would espouse.
Absolutely. And that's one of the areas where worldview consistency also comes into play. You put your finger on a couple of things that exist in a naturalistic worldview. One is that, you know, when we talk about what is our nature, a naturalist will usually say that, you know, man has this inherent dignity and worth, and we're very good and very great creatures. But then they'll turn around and say that the world is an accident, right? It's not created, it's not designed, it doesn't have any purpose or any meaning. We're just a great cosmic accident, which fundamentally undermines any notion of inherent value or dignity or worth in human beings. There's no foundation on which to build or to assume that value and dignity and worth. And so the worldview ends up being inconsistent within itself. But nonetheless, that is what they're going to argue, that we are just a cosmic accident. So,
right.
And that, again, is one of the fundamental differences in a Christian worldview and most other contemporary worldviews in America, is are we here on purpose or not? Is the world designed and ordered by God, or is it just the result of a cosmic accident, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, so now when you look at some of these non-Christian worldviews, do you find it pretty easy to detect or pinpoint these worldview inconsistencies?
Yes, and particularly once we've learned to use some of those worldview tools, which I think are essential for Christians particularly to learn to use. Because by and large, people are not aware of the inconsistencies in their own worldviews, because it's just the way that they've always looked at the world around them.
Yeah.
And it takes somebody outside of themselves to look at their worldview and point out some of these inconsistencies. So one of the things I think that we can do as believers is learn these tools for worldview analysis, learn how to look at the worldviews that our friends and our neighbors and our coworkers have, and point out these inconsistencies and say, maybe you should be looking at something else.
Yes.
Maybe you should be looking towards Christ.
Yeah, exactly. So when you talk about determining the truthfulness of a worldview, you discuss internal truthfulness, you know, external factors and existential consistency. For example, if you were to look at postmodernism, how would you apply those standards, looking at the internal, the external, and the existential consistencies, and being able to explain to a postmodernist, here's where your worldview comes apart?
Well, on the first step, internal consistency, one of the fundamental concepts in postmodernism is a denial of objective truth, or the correspondence theory of truth. We should back up and say postmodernism is a pretty slippery fish and really hard to define, but virtually everybody will acknowledge that this is one of the essential elements of postmodernism, is just a denial of objective truth, that there is a way the world really is and that we can come to understand that way that the world really is. And so if a postmodernist denies the existence of objective truth, then the question becomes, well, is it true that there is no truth? Right? Well, and if it's true that there is no truth, then there is truth. There's at least one truth, namely that there is no truth.
Yes.
Right? But if it's not true that there is no truth, well, then it's not true and we don't have to worry about it. So internally, there's a lot more involved in that, of course, but internally, the worldview ends up being inconsistent because it insists that there is no truth, And that holds for everybody. That's true for everybody. It's not just true for a postmodernist. It's also true for people that think there is no truth. It's true for us that there is no truth. Yeah. And so it's just internally inconsistent. It's like cutting off the branch that you're sitting on. In philosophy, we call it self-referential absurdity.
Yeah.
So it can't live up to its own standards. It violates itself. It contradicts itself as a worldview.
Well, right. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is we have this LGBT madness all around us all the time. And now we're being told a boy can be a girl and a girl can be a boy. And there's no such thing as gender and all the rest.
Yeah.
Now, we're into the deep weeds of insanity at this point. And I think it frustrates a lot of Christians I've talked to. How do you respond to the insane? Because you continue to put forward a biblical worldview and say, no, God created them male and female. This is biologically obvious. This is sociologically obvious. How do you deal with those sorts of issues when you begin to see a worldview truly jump the shark, as it were?
Yeah, and I mean, it can be hard, particularly with somebody who embraces that kind of perspective that, you know, we can define our own gender on our account. But one of the things that I like to do is just to try to trace back to what else has to be true for you to be able to define your own gender, right?
Well, right.
It builds directly out of a postmodern worldview that rejects the existence of objective truth, right? If
right.
there is no objective reality, then there is no objective gender that I have to live within. I can define my own gender. I create my own truth, right?
Right.
So if somebody's going to embrace that perspective, it's got to be supported by a postmodern perspective. Now, once you uncover the postmodern assumptions that lie behind it and you ask a person, well, do you really acknowledge that? Do you think that somebody can define their own reality? So, for example, even though, you know, I'm of Swedish Canadian descent, I could say, well, no, really, I want to be a black woman. Well, no, you can't be a black woman. Well, why not? Because you're not black.
Right.
But what if I say, but I want to be black. That's how I want to define myself. And so that's my reality. Just the same way that you want to be a girl, not a boy. I want to be black, not white. And who are you to tell me that I can't be? And they would say, well, the fact is that you're not black. But in order to say that, you have to acknowledge the existence of objective truth.
Yes. Yes.
Right? And if there is objective truth, then the postmodern foundation upon which the gender bending is based isn't accurate. It's not the right perception of reality. And so you can't use that as a means to go in that direction.
Well,
so I want to try to trace back to the philosophical foundation upon which the craziness around us is built and say there's something wrong with those philosophical foundations. And so the craziness shouldn't even be happening.
That's excellent. I love that, how you've unpacked it in that way, because that makes a lot of sense. Why, you know, moving somebody through this denial of objective truth and explaining how ultimately that's a logical fallacy. And what's interesting is when you meet people who have that worldview, they are very emphatic and very morally judgmental if you hold a contrary view. So that also seems to be an inconsistency that you can point out.
Yeah. And it is, and you're absolutely right. And this is why, and we don't really do this in the book, but in my classes here, I regularly tell my students that the vast majority of Americans profess to a sort of relativism, either moral relativism specifically or just relativism regarding truth in general. But I said virtually none of them actually are relativists. They just think they are, and it's a popular view to hold. But once you actually start pushing against their position, and asking them, you know, can I really just say that I'm black? I'm not white. I'm black. I want to be black. I don't want to be white. They'll say, no, that's foolish. Or if I say, well, is it really, you know, you think it's wrong to try to exterminate an entire people group, but what if Hitler thought it was right, so it was right for him, so that was his moral truth? Well, no, genocide is just wrong. So again, they think they're relativists, but they're not. And really the first step in helping eliminate some of the craziness in our society is helping people who think they're relativists realize that they're really not.
Really good. Well, a really good book to an introduction to Christian worldview, Dr. Tawa Anderson. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson. It was great to have you here.
Absolutely my pleasure, Janet.
All right. God bless you. And we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star, in theaters now, rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com. back to Janet Mefford today. Well, if you're a Christian parent or grandparent, you may hold the opinion that the world in which your kids and grandkids are growing up is a totally different world than the one in which you grew up. Case in point, technology. These days, it is often smartphones and social media and apps that are taking up large chunks of the next generation's time. We all know that's not necessarily a good thing, but as long as they're digitally connected, what should teens know about how to conduct themselves wisely in a wired-up world? We're going to tackle that today with Jonathan McKee. He speaks to parents and leaders worldwide and offers resources for parents at thesourceforparents.com. And today we'll be talking about his new book, The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices, 21 Tips to Wise Posting in an Insecure World. Great to have you back, Jonathan. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. And that was pretty good. I think you did that whole title in one breath. I'm impressed.
Well, what can I say? I got a lot of wind in me or something like that.
There you go.
Exactly. Well, I relate to this very much because I've got teenagers. I've got four kids. I know the landscape and I know how parents think about this because this is exactly where I'm coming from. We worry about things like how much time they spend online, what they're doing online, some of the pitfalls of being online. What do you hear from parents about their concerns these days regarding technology and teenagers?
Sadly, a lot of what I hear sometimes is when parents are in triage mode, you know, because we live in a world right now where, you know, over 3/4 of young people have a device like this in their pocket, don't have a smartphone, have an iPad, have an iTouch, something like that. And so, so many young people have these. Parents really overall don't really understand exactly what their kids are doing on these devices. So sadly, it's often, you know, when something catastrophic happens, when all of a sudden they find out they've been dialoguing with a stranger and all of a sudden that becomes out of control. There's a picture that was posted that the kid regretted and all of a sudden it's all around the school. There's stuff like that that happens and all of a sudden then parents are coming up and they're like, what do I do when my kid? And then finish the story right there. So sadly, that's what's happening right now is this is such a new thing. I mean, honestly, America didn't cross the 50% mark with smartphone ownership till 2012.
Wow.
So this is something in the last 5 years that we're slowly discovering. Selfies, less than 5 years old. I mean, all this stuff is brand new, and this is now something that's almost determining young people's self-esteem. And so, yeah, this is difficult for parents as we're navigating this and trying to figure it out. And that's why I'm constantly talking with young people and addressing them, such as with this book, and saying, we need to think before we post.
Absolutely.
We need to think before we make this comment. We need to think before a lot of making these decisions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, one of the tips that you talk about right at the outset is social impairment, the problem. And I think where I see this the most is when I go in airports. It strikes me the most because you'll sit in an airport and you'll be at your gate. Everybody is on a phone. Everybody. And they don't look up and they're walking with their phones and they're not looking up as they're walking. And of course, the teenagers, it's not just the teenagers, though, Jonathan, it's little kids. Here, get the iPad. Here, go on the smartphone. What about the effects of especially kids and teenagers being on their devices all the time?
Yeah, well, Janet, I mean, you mentioned it. I mean, what you're noticing is not just a kid problem, not just a teen problem. This is a people problem. I mean, this is something where when the people that are adding up the hours, and there's people like Common Sense Media and Nielsen who are adding up the exact amount of time that people are spending on their devices each day. And believe it or not, parents are outpacing young people. So you've got adults spending all this devices and they want to connect with their kids. We're spending all their time with devices. So, I mean, your typical American home, you walk in on a, you know, at 7 o'clock at night, you've got, you know, mom and dad sitting down watching a big screen, you get a teenager up in your room looking at a smaller screen, a toddler flipping colors across a tablet on the floor, and the dog's in the treadmill because no one will walk in. I mean, this is the world we're living in. So, yeah, so young people are kind of learning by watching their parents. They're learning because we all have this really cool device, and it's not the device that's bad. I mean, there's all kinds of good stuff we can do on the device, but sadly, sometimes we're so focused on connecting with people outside the room that we're ignoring the people inside of the room. And I mean, the business world is talking about this. We got best-selling authors like, you know, the books like Reclaiming Conversation by Sherry Turkle, and she even says, you know, with adults, with business associates, with husbands and wives, the mere presence of the phone on the table, you know, if you're at dinner, you're at coffee with someone, really affects the connection that two people have with each other. So this device is affecting the way we communicate. It's kind of causing us to be a little more antisocial. And so this is why we need to start dialoguing about this stuff. This is why we need to start, you know, as adults, we need to put our own devices down and find opportunities to talk with young people. And that's what I'm attempting to do here. I've always been addressing young people, but with a book like this, I'm addressing them and I'm putting in discussion questions at the end of the chapter. So if mom or dad wants to sit down and say, hey, read the Snapchat chapter and afterwards, let's go to breakfast. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, with the teenager, it's so pervasive and they're all, you know, I always lament the fact that they don't talk on the phone to each other. They're always texting. It's like they don't want to talk on the phone. They just want to text nonstop. What do you say to teenagers about developing social skills by putting down the devices? Do you have a lot of pushback from teenagers who say, I can't do it. That's the way we are social. What do you do when you talk to a teenager about that in terms of offering advice and guidance?
Well, first of all, you can't tell a teenager how to live their life. We all know that because teenagers are little punks. And we were too when we were that age. And so you can't tell them what. So whenever I address them in a school assembly or something like that, I really approach it more like, you know, as someone who's giving information. And so what I do is, you know, I approach them and kind of like tell them like stories. And young people are kind of intrigued when I tell them the history of Snapchat in chapter 10, which is, you know, because this is one of their favorite apps. And or when I tell them, you know, in chapter 17, I share about an experiment in Car and Driver magazine where researchers actually served people alcohol and tested their reaction times in a simulator. And then they compared those reaction times to sober drivers who were texting and driving. Of course, that chapter is about being distracted while you're driving, you know. And it's funny because the results of that study were eye-opening. And those are the kind of stories that speak loudly to kids. And it kind of provides them with memorable information that shapes these choices they're making. So instead of me saying, hey, you know, you need to be careful about your privacy settings, you know, instead I tell them a story of this guy, true story, this creepy guy who used location information he found in young girls' posted pics, and he would break into their houses at night and steal their underwear. Now, it's funny, when I'm telling this story at a school assembly, if I were to say, hey, everybody, you should be careful of your privacy settings, they'd be like, whatever. But when I tell this story, I can literally watch teenage girls pulling their phones out and starting to scroll through their posts and look, did I put my location? Because I don't want some creepy dude looking through my underwear drawer.
No.
You know, so this kind of anecdotal approach is tell them stories, tell them information. And you know what? Moms and dads can do this too. We can, you know, read a story in the paper. We can read a chapter in this book and say, hey, what do you think? Is he right? Is this true? What would you do if you encountered something like this? And we need to start engaging them in these conversations.
Well, and when you're young and you don't have broader experience like an adult, you tend to be more trusting. And there are a lot of areas that you address in your tips about, for example, not talking to strangers and the myth of anonymity and the permanence of your post and how it affects you down the line.
Yeah.
What about specifically the point of not talking to strangers? We tell our kids that when they go out and about. What do you advise kids to do online to protect themselves?
Well, again, I'll usually start by telling some stories of some things that happened. I mean, I was writing this book, and while I was writing it, I get, you know, parents ask me questions all the time. And this one parent said, okay, my son was gaming, and he met a friend gaming, and they were talking about their systems, and this lady's son apparently didn't have a lot of money, and his system was kind of slow. So this friend says, oh, well, I have plenty of money. I could send you money. My dad is in the oil industry. Let me send you money. Well, this lady's son gave this stranger their home address send money. So she's like, what do I do? And I said, and in all seriousness, I said, lock the doors and call the cops. She's like, is it really this serious? Well, they talked to the police. And first of all, she was surprised that the police have an actual department that handles this stuff, because this stuff happens all the time.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is sad, but young people constantly do this. And as it was, the guy did send something in the mail, sent some money, and they looked at the return address and the police researched it. It was, I'm not making this up, it was a trailer park. A lot of people from the oil industry living in trailer parks.
Oh.
But, you know, I mean, this is just one of those things that you have to, you know, I mean, this stuff happens all the time. As we talk with young people about some of these stories and let them know, and you know, this is a reality. This is something that even in the last couple months.
Yeah, it happens. Jonathan, hang on a second. We're going to come back. Jonathan McKee, The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices. We'll come right back. Stay with us. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org, and regain control over your healthcare costs. That number again, 855-585-4237 or libertyhealthshare.org. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation present The Star, the fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. Bo the donkey and his stable of animal friends follow the star to become some unlikely heroes.
That light, that's the star.
This is where it's been leading me.
What's his name?
His name is Jesus.
The Star, now playing. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information is available at thestarmovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford for Trinity Debt Management, a nonprofit Christian organization that helps people get out of debt. If credit card debt has you down, Trinity Debt Management can help. Trinity will consolidate your accounts, put a stop to late fees, and reduce your interest rate by up to 60%. Save thousands and become debt-free for keeps. Trinity provides practical solutions and creates hope for tomorrow. Call Trinity at 1-800-793-8752. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you here and great to have with us Jonathan McKee. His book, The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices, 21 Tips to Wise Posting in an Insecure World. And we've discussed some of these tips that you've offered, Jonathan, in your book. And you tell stories, as you mentioned, to teenagers who might not get a directive. But if you start telling these creepy stories, they might be a little bit more careful with their devices. That is really creepy. Yeah. Well, and this is something that kids will fall for. And not only that, but we hear these really tragic stories in the news from time to time. Oh, I met a nice young man online and we just wanted to talk online and he turned out to be a creepy pedophile when it came down to it. How do you protect kids against true danger from predators, for example?
Well, making them aware. You know, the more we tell them these stories, the more we as moms and dads and you know, caring adults, we hear these stories, read it in the paper, say, hey, what do you think? You know, do you know anybody that this happened to? And the more we keep them aware that this stuff happens, they can start to make these choices, because a lot of parents aren't talking because they feel like, I don't know anything about this. And this is one reason I try to put resources in the hands of parents, so we are a little more aware, because, and it's hard to keep up with everything, but I mean, it would help if we were aware of the main stuff. I mean, like every kid out there, Snapchat, Instagram, these are huge. We should at least know about those. And like Snapchat, for example, just came out with Snap Maps, very recently. And so Snap Maps is actually this kind of fun feature where you pinch your screen on chat on Snapchat, and all of a sudden you can see every one of your friends on a map. And it's cool because you can go, oh, look, my friends are at the mall. Oh, my friends are at school. Oh, my friends are here at the same place that I'm at. And you can zoom in and you can see their exact address of where they are at that moment. Well, the ramifications are a lot of young people aren't thinking twice about the fact that they are just putting their location out there to anyone that's one of their Snap friends right there on a map. Mm. And this is a good time to start talking with our kids about, hey, have you in person met every single person there that can see where you are at any moment?
Yeah.
You know, and do you trust every one of those people? You know, your 17-year-old daughter is at Starbucks, you know, late at night and finishes a late night study session and is about ready to go in the parking lot by herself to her car. You know, is she confident that every single person she has friended is exactly who they say they are, because they know where she is on a map right there, about ready to walk to her car? So I mean, these are the ramifications that as we talk with kids about, and some parents are like, oh, well, you know, I'll just take this device away from them. Well, guess what? She's going to be 18 sooner or later, and she's going to be in a college dorm, an army barracks or something or other, and she's going to be making these decisions on her own. Have we equipped her for that day? Mm-hmm. Have we had these conversations so she has the information to make wise decisions in such an insecure world?
Yeah, protecting your privacy. Well, another thing that you point out about Snapchat, and this is known for disappearing pictures, but you point out that Snapchat pictures don't always disappear, which I didn't realize because I'm not on Snapchat.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's, you know, and some people would be like, what do you mean they do disappear? Well, the Federal Trade Commission in 2014 actually gave Snapchat a hand slap and said, you guys are misrepresenting yourselves. And the reason why is because Snapchat has always come across with kind of this attitude of, hey, don't worry what you post because it just disappears. And FTC even said, guys, you're kind of misleading them because even though you can set the picture to disappear in a certain time, there are way to grab those pictures. The one that most people know about is by screenshotting the pic, but there were actual apps you could buy in the Apple store that were like, hey, here's how to grab these pics out of the cache in your phone. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of these abilities. So Snapchat made some tweaks. They even made a thing where if somebody does screenshot a picture, it will like appear on the person who sent it and said, your picture was just screenshotted. Uh-huh. But you can Google right now how to avoid someone knowing the screenshot, and there's people who give YouTube videos on how to avoid that message going. So, I mean, there's a lot of insecure stuff happening that young people need to be aware of. But most importantly, thinking before you post.
Good.
Because what happens all the time is, you know, a boy asks a girl, you know, hey, send me a sexy pic, and the girl will send a pic eventually, and then eventually they break up, and then the guy will always send the pic to everyone and be like, look at her, look at this tramp, you know, or some other word there. And then all of a sudden the girl goes to school one day and everybody on campus has this pic. And this is real life stuff. This is the kind of stuff that, as a matter of fact, in that Netflix show, 13 Reasons Why, kids really resonated with that. And they dealt with kind of an instance of this kind of thing where a pic went around school. This is the kind of stuff that's happening. And young people need to think before they post.
Right.
And we need to have these conversations with them.
If you could identify the perfect way for a teenager to deal with the internet, what would be that profile you'd create? For example, would there be certain sites you would say, in an ideal world, a teenager should not go on this site, not use this app, only do X, Y, and Z? Do you have that sort of formulation in your head at any time?
Well, Christian parents are always looking for that perfect list, right? You know, this site, yes, this site, no. And here's, I'm going to be honest, here's the problem with looking for that kind of list. When we look for that kind of list, and if our kids simply come to us and go, is this site okay? Nope, it's not on the list. Is this site okay? It's not on the list. The fact is, when they're 18, they're not going to look at a list. When they're 18, they're going to make the decisions on their own.
Yeah.
And what we need to do instead of giving them a list is we need to teach them the why behind the list. So the answer to your question is we need to start having some of these, we need to start having these conversations. We need to teach them things like, hey, who are you friending? You know, are you posting your location? What kind of content and comments are you making? And a lot of these conversations come up when our kid comes up. Sometimes parents really feel the pressure, but if our kid comes up and goes, Mom, can I have Instagram? I've met parents who are like, oh, I don't let my kid have Instagram. I said, well, why? Well, it's social media, and social media is bad. And they didn't even know why. I said, well, you know, here's the answer. If your kid comes up and says, can I have Instagram? If you don't know the answer, say, I don't know. Let's check it out together.
Yeah, let me look at it.
And then you go to Google. You go to a book like this, The Teen's Guide to Social Media, and you know, and you search and go, okay, Instagram safety tips, you know, Instagram parental concerns, and start reading. And, oh, okay, here's an app that where you just post pics, but it's probably good to know who can see your pics. You know, you should probably set it to where friends can't see it unless they ask you permission. And you go, oh, I've met this person face-to-face, so yes, you can see my pics. And it's probably good what you post. And you know, and as we start having these conversations, here's the why we want to be careful instead of just saying no.
Yep.
Or yes. As we teach them the why, when they go to do this by themselves, maybe they'll be like Daniel in the Bible, who when he was plucked out of his Christian, you know, his godly environment, his wholesome home, and he was put in the middle of Nebuchadnezzar's court, he resolved by himself not to defile himself. Yes. And we need to raise up Daniels who can make these decisions on their own.
Yeah, absolutely true. Going back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier on, and this issue of social impairment, and you're on your device and you're always looking down and you're not looking at the people around you sometimes. You have a tip, friend, mom, or dad. And I smiled when I saw that because I said, you know, as a parent, your time with your children is so limited, and the older they get, the more you realize that. How do you advise parents in particular to not fight with their kids necessarily and have a showdown over social media, put that down and talk to me, because that doesn't create a good relationship, but to encourage exactly. more of the face-to-face, let's do something fun together routine?
Well, it's something in my past parenting books I talk with parents about a lot. And as a matter of fact, in the book that you and I talked about before on the show, the If I Had a Parenting Do-Over, that's where I asked literally hundreds of parents, if you go back in time and you do one thing over, what would you do again? And the overwhelming answer was, I wish I would have spent more time with my kids. I wish I would have spent more time with my kids. You know, and that came out in many forms, more family dinners, more conversation, less time in front of the TV. And I think as parents have these conversations with their kids and realize the importance of a relationship. I mean, the relationship is what makes a difference in a young person's life. And we need to absolutely, you know, there's bonding and there's boundaries when it comes to parenting. And sometimes when we're worried about devices, what we do is we jump straight to boundaries. We're like, oh, I'm going to put on this porn block. I'm going to limit this screen time. And all these things can be good things. But when we jump straight to that, and neglect bonding time, bonding is where values are passed on.
That's true.
Bonding is where those conversations about real life and where the why behind stuff is really expressed. Bonding is where we as parents can, and grandparents and aunts and uncles and youth workers and coaches, where we can really make a difference in the lives of young people. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying no boundaries, but I'm saying that in a world full of these devices, we need to look up from our devices. We need to find opportunities to have conversation. We need to have no tech zones, like no tech at the table, where family conversation happens. And then as mom and dads, we also need to go beyond that and find opportunities where we bake cookies and we do different things where kids' hands are dug into the cookie dough bowl and not on their phones, but we're all laughing and talking with cookie dough all over our fingers and talking. We got to find those natural communication arenas where just conversation's happening instead of us all being buried in our devices.
Well, I love that. Great advice. The name of the book, The Teen's Guide to Social Media and Mobile Devices, Jonathan McKee. His website, thesourceforparents.com. Always good to talk to you, Jonathan. Thanks again for being here.
Oh, always good to be here. Thank you.
All right. God bless you. And thanks again for joining us. Thank you, too, for being with us here on Janet Mefford Today. We'll see you next time. This hour has been brought to you by The Star, presented by Affirm Films and Sony Pictures Animation. The fully animated story of the first Christmas told through a whole new set of eyes. The Star in theaters now. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. More information at thestarmovie.com.